number 9822, reel 2.
Yes, I think that was later on in 1942, perhaps July or August.
You talked about going out on patrol from Gibraltar. What exactly did that involve?
Well, that this was the famous submarine flotilla, the 10th flotilla, where all the VCs were awarded, Wanklyn and Tubby Linton and all the rest of them. And they were mostly U-class submarines, and I think we were the first or second of the S-class submarines to go there. And we were designated patrol areas, perhaps off North Africa somewhere, Tripoli somewhere, off where the Italians and the German army were, or perhaps off Italy or Sicily, or even off the south coast of France. And what we would do is we'd be sent on patrol, we'd spend a couple of days sort of getting there, sort of travelling on the surface at night, and dive by day. And then just lie in a patrol area, slowly going up and down until we saw something that was worth attacking. And at night we'd surface and charge our batteries, and by day we'd stay underwater.
How often would you make attacks? Every day?
Oh, no, only if we saw some ships or saw anything passing. We actually sank quite a number of ships. I forgot how many ships there were we had a Jolly Roger. All submarines had a Jolly Roger, which somebody in the crew made up, and it was skull and crossbones. And for every merchant ship you sank, you put a white bar on this thing. For every warship you sank, you put a red bar on it. For every U-boat you sank, you put a red bar with a U in it. And sometimes you used to have what we call gun actions, because most of these submarines had a gun, a forward gun. Some of them had a gun aft as well. And if you saw something that wasn't worth firing a torpedo at, or was too shallow to fire a torpedo at, like a landing craft, or the Italians were using a lot of very small boats to transport goods and food and so forth between Sicily and Italy, what we used to do is have a gun action, and you'd suddenly shoot up to the surface, the gun's crew would pour out forward, and you'd fire half a dozen shells at this thing, whatever it was, and from about 50 yards away, and sink it. We did quite a lot of that. For every one of those that you did, you put a set of cross guns on your Jolly Roger. And there were various other signs on the Jolly Roger for clandestine landing operations, where you'd landed somebody on the enemy coast, commandos or something like that. We had one awkward one to get on, because we spent one of them, I imagine the captain was probably a bit bored, but we spent one day as railway runs along the coast of Italy. There are various places that it travels along the sides of the mountains where it has a viaduct it goes over, and we spent some days just firing shells at these viaducts from half a mile offshore. And that sort of thing, you see. Anything to keep them confused.
Did you ever get into any sticky situations?
Yes, again, you know, it's 44 years or 43 years ago, and it's hard to remember, but I remember the things that I distinctly remember are, one of them was going to Malta from Gibraltar. We had to go through a minefield, and I think we went through it at probably about 150, 160 feet depth, and you could actually hear the wires of the mine scraping down the side of the submarine on a number of occasions. There must have been at least six or seven of them, and that was a bit dicey. There were other occasions when we were depth charged, of course. Those were too numerous to mention. I mean, we were caught up in attacks by Italian or German surface vessels on a number of occasions. I remember one particular, being the navigator, I used to stand at the chart table while all this kerfuffle was going on in the control room, and I used to spend my time counting off depth charges in fives. I think the most I ever got up to was about 160. But we were never hit. They caused leaks. Somebody started to leak, but we were very quiet, and we had a brilliant captain who got us out of all these scrapes.
So 160 depth charge on one occasion?
On one occasion, yeah. Not all close. I mean, some of them were a long way away because they never quite knew where. You see, the Italians didn't have, I don't think the Germans did either, didn't have ASDIC. They didn't have the ping things that we had. They just had listening devices and they had to listen. And we were a very quiet submarine, providing you had your trim right. We were just going absolutely dead slow ahead on one motor, and that was the only sound there was.
By the trim, you mean the balance?
The balance of the boat in the water, yeah.
How frightening was it when you were under depth charge attack?
Well, I can't say I was ever frightened. It was exciting, really, but I can't say I was ever terrified or, you know, the lights would go out and. Just like that film on the U-boat, the lights would all suddenly go out and they'd come on, and the night lights would come on, and somebody suddenly report a leak from aft and mad panic to try and get it sealed up again. But I never really felt scared.
Why did the lights go off?
Well, presumably I don't know why the lights went out. Presumably the depth charges were so close that they blew a fuse or. Triggered a switch somewhere, but it didn't take long to get them on again each time.
During the depth charge attack, would most of the crew just be lying in their bunks?
Very quietly in their bunks, yes. Everybody would be lying or sitting wherever they were, very quiet. The only people really operating would be the captain walking up and down the control room, the first lieutenant would be controlling the trim, and the three operators, one operating the fore planes, one operating the after planes, hydroplanes, and the helmsman, of course, who was steering the boat. And that occasionally, if the first lieutenant had to make an adjustment to the trim, there'd be a slight sound of a pump when it pumped water forward or aft or in or out from the boat.
Why was the captain so brilliant?
Well, I think most British submarine captains were pretty brilliant during the war. They really were. They were so young. I mean, they were only in their mid-20s, really. But they were very clever.
In what way, though, specifically?
Well, it seemed to me that they knew exactly what... I don't know about the next lot that came off, but the captains I was involved with were all people who had been in submarines before the war. They'd joined submarines as part of their naval life. And consequently, they'd been with other... Before they actually got a command, and this was John Bromage's first command in 1940... I think it was his first command in 42. So from 39 to 42, he must have been with... Well, he was with some other older and more experienced captains where he'd learned his trade. And, of course, he'd been in all sorts of attacks by enemy ships for 3 years of the war.
Did you sink any warships in the Mediterranean?
The only thing we sank was a U-boat. Well, we never saw a warship, as far as I can remember.
Where did you go after this?
After Saeb, well, I had an unfortunate accident whilst I was in the Mediterranean, navigator of Saeb, and we were on the depot ship. We were in Algiers then. We moved from Gibraltar. Once the British forces had taken Algiers, we moved across to Algiers, and we were based on Algiers doing the same sort of submarine patrols. And I was involved in an accident. I broke a bone in my foot, and the submarine side went on patrol without me. Somebody else went on board to take my place, one of the spare crew, and she was sunk on her next patrol. I've talked to John Bromage since and found out what happened, but everybody was taken prisoner of war. The whole crew was about 47, and all 47 of them were taken prisoner of war. They were heavily attacked by four Italian patrol boats, and the Italians, as I said, had no ASDIC, but they had these listening devices. Of course, when they were running on their engines, the patrol boats, all they could hear was their own engines. Basically, they had to stop to listen. But these cunning devils, they'd built some patrol boats which ran on diesel electric. So they ran the diesel engine to get them from A to B, but once they picked up a target or a submarine, they just went off the diesel onto the motor, and they were as quiet as the submarine then, and they were able to listen into exactly where the side was, and they depth charged it and brought it to the surface. And all the crew got out and they scuttled the ship.
Where did you go after you recovered from your foot injury?
Well, I was brought home then to a hospital here at Seaforth. I had my leg in plaster for about 6 weeks. And when I reported back for duty again, I was made first lieutenant of a submarine called H-44, which again was going back to one of these old 1914-18 war type of submarines. And we were based in Londonderry, doing this ASDIC running again, going out in the morning, coming in at night. A very unexciting period of my life. And it was as a result of that that I eventually... I had a sub-lieutenant with me, who was the third hand, and the two of us volunteered. A signal came from the Admiralty one day asking for volunteers for special and hazardous service, and we both volunteered.
Why did you want to do that?
Well, I wanted to get away from this ping running, really. I wanted to do something a bit more exciting. And as a result of that, we both found ourselves sent to HMS Varbel, which was based on Rothsay, which is the shore base at Rothsay, for the 12th Submarine Flotilla, which was the submarine flotilla that dealt in all the special projects, like midget submarines, human torpedoes, and all different types of underwater craft.
How do you spell Varbel?
V-A-R-B-E-L. The name came about through a Commander Varley and Commander Bell, who invented this midget submarine.
And what were these midget submarines like?
Well, I was quite surprised when I saw my first one. They were a submarine. They weren't like the human torpedoes that you put on a diving suit and sat astride. They were a proper submarine. They were about 57 feet long, about 13 feet in from top to bottom, and the actual hull width was about 6 feet. You could stay at sea for 3 weeks in them, up to 3 weeks in them, with your own food, and they had an engine, a Gardner diesel engine. They had a motor. You had a range of about 1,000 miles on the surface, and they were a proper submarine. Two periscopes.
What was the training for that like?
Well, I had 6 weeks training for that. But it wasn't training, really. I mean, as soon as I arrived there at Varbel, I was made commanding officer of one of these midget submarines. X-24 I was put in command of first. That was a training submarine. And I just worked up a crew in that. I had a crew of 12 altogether. The actual crew of the submarine was 4. But you had another 4 who were in the... Because of their range and because of their size, when they went on operations, they were towed by a larger submarine on the end of a 600-foot tow rope from A to B. In the case of the Tirpitz, for instance, they were towed from Scotland all the way across to the Norwegian fields, about 1,000 miles, I think it was. Anyway, quite a long way. And then during that tow, which took 3 or 4 or 5 days, there'd be a crew in the submarine, and that was the first passage crew. When you got to the operational area, they were taken out of the midget submarine, and the operational crew were put on board by rubber dinghy. The operational crew would then slip the tow, or let go of the tow, go into the... to do the attack on whatever the object was that we were going to attack, come out again, and then they would transfer to the large submarine, and the second passage crew would be put on board for the tow back again. So that's why you had 12 people. There were 4 in each of these crews.
What were the operations that you first went on with with the X-craft?
Well, I only did the one operation. Basically, we all only did one operation. Well, the war was coming to an end anyway, but whilst I was with X-craft, one X-craft was towed to Bergen. Two X-crafts were towed to Bergen in Norway, and they attacked a floating dock there. The X-craft, there were two methods of attacking the X-craft. You didn't have torpedoes. There are two methods of attacking. One was that they each aircraft had two side, what we call side cargoes. Those were big sort of tanks on the side of the aircraft which could be released from inside. And each one of them had about 4 tons of high explosive in them. And a time clock, of course. And you could set the time clock from inside the submarine, and then just by winding a handle you flooded the thing, and your last few clicks, a few turns of the wheel, released them, and they just fell off underneath the target. You went underneath the target and dropped them underneath. And the other way, the other method we had, instead of having these side cargoes full of explosive, we had the same tanks on the sides, but they were filled with limpet mines, and we could carry 6 limpet mines on each side, each holding about 200 pounds of high explosive. And these were attached by magnets to the bottom of the ship. So you got under the ship, put your diver out through a special escape hatch, and he then went under the ship and stuck the limpet mines on. The time fuses were all set previously leaving harbour, and all the diver had to do was pull a little cotter pin out of a hole, and that started the time clock.
What was this operation that you went on?
The operation I went on, the war in Europe was coming to an end, and they decided that there was nothing further that X-Craft could do. And so we all were hoisted on board, 6 X-Craft were hoisted on board a depot ship called HMS Bonaventure, which was a converted clan liner. She had one of these, well, she had a very heavy lifting derrick fore and aft. And we were taken to, her original name was the Clan Campbell, incidentally, when she was a clan liner. And we were taken in her to Australia, where we went to the Barrier Reef and started doing some working up exercises on getting underneath ships and cutting submarine telephone cables and various things like that. And eventually we went to a place called Labuan in Borneo, and I was delegated an operation to go into Singapore Harbour to attack and stick limpet mines under a Japanese battleship, a Japanese battle cruiser called the Takeo.
How do you spell it?
That's spelled T-A-K-A-O. Now, from Borneo, from Labuan in Borneo to Singapore, to the Singapore Straits, was a tow of about 600 miles. So we set sail on whatever date it was in July 1945, being towed by a submarine called the Stygian. And we were towed from Borneo to the Horsburgh Light, which is the entrance to the Straits of Singapore, Singapore Strait. And there we did the crew change. The passage crew got off, and I and my operational crew got on. We then went, we slipped the tow, and we made the passage up the Straits of Singapore until we came to the island of Singapore itself. Now, this cruiser that we'd been detailed to attack was lying at the Old Admiralty Dockyard, which was on the north side of Singapore Island, and it meant going some 12 miles up a narrow channel around the north end of Singapore Island, which is called the Johor Strait. So we started off, we went through the boom, which the gate of which was open at the entrance to the harbour, at about 9 o'clock in the morning on the 31st of July 1945 excuse me, and navigated our way up this channel, which about, I suppose, about half a mile or a mile wide, until we saw the Takeo. And once I'd sighted it, it was heavily camouflaged, lying very close inshore on the north end of Singapore Island, with its stern towards the island and its bows pointing up through Borneo, not Borneo, up through through Burma, up that way, because the British forces were coming down through there, and they thought that this ship was going to act as a bombarding centre to bombard them. And I let all my crew have a look through the periscope, or the other 3 chappies in the crew. One of them was a New Zealander, Christian name I can't remember, but we called him Keeley Smith. Had an engineering artificer called Charlie Reed, and my diver was the leading seaman, McGuinness. And I let them all have a look at the Takeo through the periscope before we started the attack. And eventually we got close enough, and we started to attack it. We ran in and went underneath it. Settled on the bottom, opened the door, put the diver out, And when McGuinness got out, he found that the bottom of the ship was very, very, it had been there a long time, heavily encrusted with barnacles. But he took the limpet mines out, but he had to scrape the bottom of the ship with his diving knife to get a bit of clear plate for him to attach the magnets. And he had quite a considerable job doing it. It took him about 40 minutes to put the six limpet mines on. He then came back into the submarine again. We flooded down and we couldn't get out because the tide had gone down. We were in a very narrow hole under this thing. There was hardly any room. And the tide had gone out and a foot or so. Anyway, the ship had sunk down also, and we just couldn't move. And it took me about 20 minutes. I mean, I was a bit frantic. I really did feel a bit frightened then. I was a bit frantic. Of going full ahead, full astern, blowing tanks, filling tanks, just trying to nudge a hole in the seabed so we could climb out. And eventually we did. We came out and went up a bank and onto the seabed proper, where we found that one of the side cargoes, because once the limpet mines are placed, you just release the side cargoes because you don't want to be towing those all the way back with you. One of them hadn't come off and it was stuck. Because he gave you a lopsided view, you see, he was sort of over to the starboard all the time. And McGuinness had to go out again in his diving suit and lever this thing off, which he did, about 50 yards away from this cruiser, in about 30 feet of water, very clear water. And the enemy looking down must have been able to see a black shape out there, if they had looked there. And make matters worse, his diving suit was leaking, so he was sending a stream of bubbles up to the surface all the time. But eventually he released the side cargo, got in again, and we made our way out of the Johor Strait back. The gate was still open, the boom got out through the gate and out to sea, and eventually we were picked up by the larger submarine and towed back to Singapore.
Why was the gate in the boom open?
I've no idea. Maybe they never closed it, I don't know. It was the old British boom that the British had put there in their days in Singapore before the Japanese captured the place. And they had boom vessel on the boom for closing it, but I think they were so self-assured that nothing was going to go in there, and that was apart from their own ships, they didn't need to close it.
But you'd banked on it being open?
No, we hadn't. If the boom had been open, we had a method of putting the you put the bow of the midget submarine into the net, into the submarine net, and the diver went out, and with a hydraulic cutter he cut a damn great hole in it, which he went through, and we'd have had to do that to get in. And again, we'd have had to do it to come out if the gate hadn't been open.
So it saved you a lot of delay. Why did you let the crew have a look at the cruiser before you attacked?
Well, I thought it was quite an exciting thing to see, and I thought they might like to see it, so I let them have a look at it. And of course, when you go underneath the cruiser, when you do your attack and you eventually go underneath the thing, there's a porthole in the top of the submarine which you can look through. And you go under, as a captain, you go under very slowly, as slow as you can possibly go, and it's bright daylight, and you suddenly see it getting darker and darker and darker. Then you can suddenly see the plates of the hull with the weeds hanging down and the rivet holes, the rivets and all that sort of thing. You stop the submarine and give it a little bit of stern and stop dead.
So the water was extraordinarily clear.
It was very, very clear, yeah.
So, how long did you have between the explosives being attached and getting away?
Well, the side cargo, I'd carried a mixture for this attack. One of the tanks on the side was, in actual fact, 4 tons of high explosive. The tank on the other side held 6 limpet mines, and I had two more limpet mines in the casing, because if the attack had gone exactly according to plan, I intended going to see if there's any other ships that I could stick a couple more of them under. But unfortunately, we were a couple of hours late because there was a tidal current which we hadn't allowed for. The time fuse on the main charge was set for 6 hours. In other words, this thing was all over by about 3 o'clock. It was due to go off about 9 o'clock that night. And the limpet mines were all set to a similar time fuse, to go off 6 hours after the pin had been pulled out. But they all had a countermining device, which was a couple of sort of needle heads stuck together with a sleeve over them. And once you started the clock, the sleeve started to move back and just left the two needle heads together. So if anybody had got hold of the charge and pulled it, or banged it, the needles would have dropped apart and the charge would have gone off, and of course all the other charges would have, the same thing would have happened, it would have set all the others off as well. Anyway, they were set to go off 9 hours later, and I was on my way on the surface. We were very tired by this time. We'd been in the submarine something like 56 hours, and of course you don't sleep very well in those little tiny things, and we'd been on we'd been taking benzodiazepine tablets to keep ourselves awake. But once I'd surfaced at night, and we'd been dived about 52 hours or something, we'd been dived about 19 or 20 hours, and of course the air in the submarine was getting a bit rank, and although we had an oxygen cylinder which was feeding oxygen in all the time, and we had air purifiers in it which was putting the air in the submarine through filters to get rid of the carbon monoxide, or carbon dioxide is it, I'm not sure what it is, and we surfaced and started the engine, which flushed the submarine out with fresh air. I let them all come up on the top casing to have a little bit of exercise, walk around and swing their arms a bit. And at 9 o'clock, I stopped the submarine and got them all up on deck just to see if we could see anything when these things were due to go off, or 9:30 when they were due to go off. And at the precise time, there was a violent explosion over Singapore, from the back of Singapore Island. It really was a magnificent explosion. And we thought, well, that's it. We all had a little cheer and got our underway again. And we had these things on board, what we used to call black light. It was a special light, infrared or infra something light, which you switched on. And with a special pair of binoculars, you could see it. If you hadn't got the special pair of binoculars, you couldn't see it, you see. And the Stygian, which was our towing submarine, had one of these. And eventually, looking through my special binoculars, I picked it up. And we came alongside, changed the crews again. We went on board, and the other passage crew came on, and it was towed back to Labuan. When I got back to Labuan, a couple of days later, I went up with Captain Fell, who was the captain of the depot ship at Bonaventure, and had a look at the aerial photographs that had been taken over the spot. And the old Takeo was still there, albeit sitting on the bottom, presumably. I mean, you couldn't really tell, because she was in very shallow water. But she hadn't sort of blown into smithereens. And Captain Fell said, well, you know, we've got to do something about this. You'll have to go back again and have another go at it. Well, that really did upset me, having done one, what I thought was a considerably successful attack. To go back again. But nevertheless, we said okay, and we were fixed to go back 7 days later, 7 or 8 days later. And I can't remember the exact dates now, but I always remember sitting on deck of Bonaventure watching a film, and we'd all got victualled up and new stores and everything on board, victualled up, sitting on board Bonaventure, ready to watching a film, and the film was stopped. The captain came out and told us that they'd dropped a nuclear bomb on Nagasaki or Hiroshima, whichever was the first one, and the operation had been delayed or put off for a while. And of course then they dropped the second bomb and the Japanese capitulated, so we didn't have to go back to Singapore. I was very grateful for that. That's why I'm so fond of nuclear bombs.
So you were awarded the VC for this attack on the Takeo?
I was awarded the VC.
I
was awarded the VC, and leading seaman McGuinness, who was my diver, was also awarded the VC.
What did the citations say, approximately?
Oh, I honestly can't remember. But it was for this particular attack on this particular Japanese cruiser.